Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
I'm not hearing myself.
Test, test, test. Nope.
There you are.
There you are. Oh, we're in delay.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr.
The studio's in delay. We can't hear ourselves.
It is Saturday. Okay, let me... And you... Oh, you lucky people. You're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
There we go. Are we here?
What are we? August 26th, Anno Domini 2023.
There, let's see.
All right.
Okay.
Is this the show?
Now we're live, but we have an echo.
Yeah.
Hopefully this sounds a lot better on the radio. Yeah.
For Don Mattingly.
Hold on.
Rob, what buttons did you mess up on our board? Let's see. The echo's gone.
There we go. It's in that... I keep forgetting, and it's even worse with hearing aids.
Yeah. I'm sure.
It's like, you know, hearing things going on in your mind, and I hear enough things. I don't need that, too.
Ugh.
But as you folk can realize...
You hope.
Due to the confusion, Nick is still not here. He is still recovering. He's been posting on Facebook and everything else.
And he does listen to the show, we've heard.
And is recouping, so you know, we expect him back relatively soon, we hope.
Yeah.
And get him back in here and hear his mellow tones.
Yeah, mellow tones, in all caps.
And then some. But no, he's doing really good and sends his best. And all the folks that have been sending him, congrats and, you know, speedy recovery and all that other stuff.
But. Okay. Yeah, it's true. We all miss Nick, and we can tell you that he is recovering. He is recouping. He says he's getting stronger every day, and we are very anxious and really looking forward to seeing him in the very near future. And as we know more, we'll be sure to share it with you too.
And hopefully, once he makes it to a spot where he can come on remotely.
Yeah.
Versus needing to come all the way to the studio, we can get him there too.
Right.
Yeah. One thing Steve and I were talking about just before we went on the air is, you know, we've been talking lately how you go into most stores now,
right?
You don't see the big boxes. All you're seeing are laptops, tablets, and phones.
Sure.
Well, there's a new thing that I've been seeing out on the market.
Okay.
And trying to get the name of it, but...
You know, you see that one cool thing, and then you can never find it again. And you bookmark it, and you lose it within your millions of other bookmarks.
Other bookmarks, yes, because of all the cool things you found.
Yeah, I was looking for the name. And
okay.
Literally, it's a 4K mini PC that has an all-new N100 CPU.
Okay.
N100 mini PC, 16 gigs DDR4 RAM.
All right.
1 terabyte... SSD.
Okay.
Runs Windows 11, dual HDMI 4, and Wi-Fi 6.
Wow. Amazing.
And
that's a nice little unit. It'll let you run a couple of monitors simultaneously.
But here's the kicker.
Okay.
Only $50.
What?
I'm seeing a bunch of different computers using that same N100 chip. Is that their ARM
competitor
to Apple Silicon?
It could be. It's very possible.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, if somebody's looking to play around and not have a huge box, which, you know, for me, I've got 1, 2, 3 Raspberry Pi 4s that are running servers. Set them up as individual servers for backup. Excuse me, redundancy. And I've got one for me, one for my wife, and then one that we share so that we're, you know, backing up to three different places.
Right.
Oh, yes. So please, everyone, get a backup drive.
Yeah.
I have six.
At a minimum.
I have six recoveries going in the office today.
Oh, Is it recovery season?
Yeah, we've already had a couple of college students say, you know, I'm leaving for college in the morning. I need my computer fixed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
sorry.
Well,
come back at the beginning of the summer. Yeah.
Right.
One of them was fairly easy.
Or pay the priority rate.
Yeah. One of the recoveries was kind of easy. It was an external drive.
Yeah.
And the USB-C connector broke off.
Oh.
So I was able to get the chassis open.
Right, and extract the drive.
Right. I've seen some brand drives where the USB is soldered directly to the drive itself.
Yes, I've seen that.
Fortunately, this was a USB to SATA adapter.
Okay.
So I could pull that off and get to the real SATA ports. So that data is all recovered.
Good. That's straightforward.
Yeah, now I've got two spinning hard drives and three SOCs.
Oof.
That are going to be almost impossible to recover.
So what are you...
Go ahead.
This just in...
Yeah, Nick is listening, and he said NUC, next unit of computing.
Right. Well,
these are beyond, I think, the next unit. This is the next unit. So the NUCs were like little
N-squared.
Yeah, little hardware pucks.
But yeah, they're very compact, folks. I mean, they're no bigger than, I'd say, like a bar of soap.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And these are available today?
Yeah, you can order them.
Yeah, I'm seeing from B-Link and TrigKey and Asus.
Okay.
And
I've heard of one of those brands.
Yes.
And the other thing, too, though, is I noticed, because I was just talking last night to a friend of mine about Kanakit.
Okay.
Kanakit now has their Raspberry Pi 4s back up and in stock.
Amazing.
They are shipping, you know, before you had to.
Raspberry Pis have been hard to find for a long time.
Yeah, you had to put in a date, and then it was an anticipated ship date.
Right.
Now you can call and...
Somebody plug that in.
I got it. Go ahead. Keep going, Dave.
So, yeah, they had an anticipated ship date of when you might get it because of the availability of chips on their end. But that is now, I guess, no longer an issue that you can go to the... Which I recommend because we were comparing prices, you know, some other places, and then going right to Kanakit.
And Kanakit is the company that sells these?
Yeah, that put these packages together. And Kanakit is very reasonable. Matter of fact, we were pricing, like I say, different places, and on the average, it was about $20 cheaper.
Okay.
Whether you either got a 4-gig unit or an 8-gig unit.
Got it.
For the $20, you know, and even between a 4-gig and an 8-gig within Kanakit, there is a $20 difference.
Hmm.
But, you know, I recommend going to 8-gig.
Okay.
You never have too much power.
No, yeah.
Especially when you're running everything in this little box.
And a lot of times what's becoming common now in the PC world that we've been facing in the Mac for the last few years, everything's on one chip. You cannot increase the RAM. You cannot increase the internal storage. You can add another drive, but you cannot increase the internal storage.
Right, or the internal the internal working memory.
Yeah.
Well, with these, at least you can add an
soldered.
Yeah, you can always add an extra drive.
SSD hard drives.
Yep.
And... But the thing of it is, which is nice, is, you know, you have this extra speed, you know, and you go to the 8-gig, that way it moves along fast.
All three
of my servers, even though they're servers,
mm-hmm.
and they sit for the most part, you know, just sitting around throughout the day, you know, other than backing up, I've got it set so they sync every so often with my other files, but they're fast. And they're, you know, very efficient because I'm running with SSD hard drives.
Right.
And they're great little boxes, but that's the way it's going. Like I said, people are getting away from the big boxes, the big PCs, unless they're into gaming and all this other
sure.
stuff. Need a high-end graphics card, you know.
And the ability to replace it as time goes on.
Yeah, the graphics card has to really kick butt. You know, it's probably a $1,000 video card in it.
Can be.
Yeah, with some of these gamers, I've seen it. No big deal.
Right. Well, yeah, I'd say unless you have a specific industry application or a specific entertainment application that you're trying to fulfill, Some of these single board computers, whether they are these new models or even some of the micro form factor PCs that some of the more established brands have had for a long time, those are very, very tempting, especially mm-hmm. for the more typical email, web browsing, some online video, some miscellaneous streaming video, where you just really want just enough. The price entry point for that is really getting good.
Yeah. And like I say, a lot of these Raspberry Pi packages that we recommend, one other thing I would recommend for them, especially if you go with a 4 or an 8 in mm-hmm. the newer chipsets, is get a case with fan.
Okay.
A fan is a very, I mean, you're talking about a unit. Granted, they've got heat sinks and that on them, but you can buy the cases. And I forget the name of the company. I'll have to look it up, but I got one that builds some really nice kits.
Yeah.
And they have the built ones with the fans, and they're a nice big, and here's the other key thing. It's very quiet.
Mm.
You're not hearing this fan unit running in the background while you're trying to do something else.
Yeah.
And but definitely, you want a unit with a fan.
So active cooling rather than
just
putting an aluminum heatsink on the chips.
Those little heat sinks, for the amount of power and everything else that these units are putting out, it's to your best interest.
Sure, it helps preserve the unit. Mm. Mm-hmm. So when the unit runs hot, it's essentially wearing itself out, mm-hmm. right? So if a unit runs too hot for too long, it just is not going to have the longevity that you can expect from a unit if you properly cool it.
Yep.
I was doing a storage drive upgrade on the Mac Pro 2013 trash can cylinder tower.
Yes.
It's got this giant fan on the top,
right,
and giant vents on the bottom. And the SSD flash drive
is vertical.
Vertical with a little tiny heatsink on it.
Now, that was one of the first times I remember seeing a Edge Connector storage unit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't exactly M.2. It was, I think, an Apple proprietary
kinda,
connector.
Yeah. Using part of the NVMe spec that no one else uses, of course.
Right, right.
Pretty much all the MacBook Airs used that same type of Edge connector
mm-hmm.
up until they went to the SoC.
And some of the MacBook Pros, the early...
Yep, the MacBook Pros, yeah.
Before the Touch Bar series.
And then on the iMac, when they had the Fusion drive...
Yes.
So the spinning mechanical drive was a regular drive,
mm-hmm.
But then it had the second blade drive... for SSD for speed. So in the early days, big SSDs were really expensive. Today they're just expensive. And so Apple had this thing for a while they called Fusion Drive. So there was part SSD for speed that it would put your OS and your apps on and recently used files, and then a big spinning drive that you could store a lot of stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in a special RAID format, so the user only sees one volume. And the OS handles moving things back and forth as it likes to.
Mm-hmm.
That was 2015, 2016, 2017 era.
Yeah.
We're starting to see a lot of those drives fail now.
Yeah.
And like most RAID, you know, not quite RAID 0, it's not a RAID mirror, it's a RAID bunch of disks.
Right.
When one drive fails, you lose all the data on both of them.
Mm.
So we had one of those last week where it failed. Fortunately, they had a backup.
Uh-huh.
So we could put in a new SSD. So then we had a big SSD and a little SSD. And when I'm running the Fusion Recreate, it says, this is not standard, but okay.
But not acceptable. Yeah.
It'll work. Yeah. It'll work.
Don't leave that 128 gig SSD just laying in there. I'll add it to the 2000 gig I put in.
Was it true that the SSD was a separate piece of storage? So it was actually copying files from one to the other? It wasn't just caching versions of it locally?
It was a separate storage drive, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so it is possible that you could lose data if that happened to
It was almost
fail.
A JBOD.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of disks.
Right.
But there was some trickery in the OS that the system files were on the fast disk.
Yeah.
Applications were on the fast disk.
It was always a bit of a bodge.
It was
we really want to offer high speed and high capacity.
Right.
And
when a 1 terabyte SSD was $1,000.
Right. Right. And it was way more dollars than people were ready to spend, but they still really wanted the speed. macOS at the time was really good at taking advantage of the speed, but it was just, we just did not have the capacity that we needed. I know that where I work during the week, we ran into a situation in that era where we opted for the SSD option. We said, all right, that's fine.
Yep.
We're going to give you a bunch of storage on our local servers, a bunch of cloud storage to put things in. And it was a problem because we were handing out machines with only 128 gigs. And by the time you put a full OS on those and got some miscellaneous documents and whatnot, it really was essentially a network computer. Because if you weren't connected to the network and weren't able to access the outboard storage, it was you could not expect to hold very much locally.
Yeah, when Apple went SSD only, they started with 128 gig drives.
Yeah.
So your OS and bundled applications take up 20-25 gigs.
Sure.
And if all you're doing is you know, word processing files, that's probably fine.
Right.
But you start putting pictures on there. Oh, just put them on the cloud.
Or pop three email.
Yeah, no. Right. Yeah. Yo, just put it on the cloud. I don't want to pay for cloud space.
Right. No, yeah. Or I've got all these attachments to my email. Oh, yeah. Aunt Betty sent me the photos from the family reunion. And it suddenly, you know, hey, where'd all my drive space go?
Yep. At the air show last week, even though I was emceeing, I still took 2,000 pictures.
Okay.
I'm weeding through them to take out the empty sky or half the airplane that was shooting by. And
right. Oh, I was watching an interesting video yesterday. It was a kit of an SR-71.
Oh, yeah.
That,
Horizon just released a new...
It looks like it's a few $100 with two EDFs.
Twin 40mm EDFs, yeah.
Yeah, it looked like a neat machine. I mean, that's always been my favorite Air Force.
The SR-71 is very tricky to fly with that big delta wing.
Yes.
You have a really high angle of attack as you're landing.
Yeah, I noticed that. And they talked about something called SAFE, where they had an option to turn it on, and I was only picking it up through context that it looked like it was attempting to help it fly more level or in a bit more slow, less twitchy.
We've seen a lot of technology come into the RC community with first were gyro stabilizations.
Yes.
So it takes the wind into account and can keep the plane level.
Mm-hmm.
And then SAFE is sensor envelope flight assist.
Okay.
And it sort of has two functions. It has bank limits, so you can't overroll it and lose control. And if you let go of the sticks, it goes back to straight and level.
Oh, I see.
Cool. So sometimes they call that panic recovery.
Yes. Yep. It's like the traction control and what's that other one? Stability control for your model.
A lot of the old timers hate it.
Sure.
They call it a crutch,
it's a flying aid.
No, it's called saving money.
Right. I normally fly with SAFE on. I can still crash. You can still crash. Just it's a little harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I joke that I couldn't enjoy the hobby without this technology.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that good a pilot. I'm enthusiastic.
Sure.
I'm just not that good a pilot.
Well, you know, in the cycling world, we've had the proliferation of electronic bikes, electric bikes that have a battery and an electric motor to help assist the rider, allow them to ride
farther.
That's
just cheating.
Well,
if you're in a competition, maybe.
Well, yes. If you're in a competition, they are not allowed. They
unless they're all e-bikes.
Well, those are called motorcycles. So there is a division in the cycling world, or at least there was for a while, and I think it's calmed down to a point. But there are lots of people who want to go ride with their friends, with their spouse, and they just may not be as strong, and they don't want to hop on a tandem with the other person, but they want to be able to keep up, or they want to be able to ride a little bit further than they might need to.
Uphill takes too hard, and downhill goes too fast.
Right, and the options available these days, especially for people who want to commute, the options are fantastic these days.
Yep.
Of course, an e-bike tends to be a little more expensive, but there's a lot extra going on. But we're seeing, there are aids and enhancements to the traditional style of both model airplanes and bicycles that are allowing more people to enjoy those activities. And I say the more people doing either one of those, the better.
Yep.
It's better for the entire industry as a whole. So I'm looking forward to seeing all of us welcome everybody on two wheels and welcome everybody who's flying and enjoying the hobby. I mean, that helps keep the clubs alive. That helps keep
and
everybody, the entire industry.
Okay. Oh, we got a caller? Oh, sorry. Yeah,
I was going to say, we got a caller, William from Hamilton, Virginia. Go ahead, sir.
Hampton.
I'm sorry.
Oh,
yeah. That's
please.
Okay, Dave. Dennis, Steve, how are you guys?
Doing great. Yourself, sir?
Well, quite well, thanks. I was listening to your discussion. It's absolutely correct. with RAID, you can lose your data, particularly if it's RAID 0.
Yep.
RAID 1, if I remember correctly, uses striping, and then RAID 5 uses a parity check, and RAID 10 uses striping and mirroring. So you can still preserve your data, but you have to choose the configuration that's most optimal for doing so.
Right. RAID 1 is with two drives. It writes the same data to both drives, so that if you if one drive fails, you don't lose any data.
Right. And RAID 0 is that striping.
Striping with half the data is written to each drive, so it can go twice as fast. So
sure.
We sometimes call it scary fast RAID because
yep.
It's fast, but not backed up.
And the way you can remember which one is dangerous is because RAID 0 has a 0 in it, and yeah. 0 is the amount of data you're going to get back if either one of yep. those drives fails.
And then RAID 5 will use three drives, and it uses one of the drive as a extra drive.
Mm-hmm.
So if any one drive, so with a three drive RAID, you get the capacity of two drive total. And if any one drive fails, you don't lose any data, and you can just put that replacement drive in there.
Right.
And then when they start doing RAID 10 and RAID 50, so 10 is sometimes called 0 plus 1.
Mm-hmm.
So it's striped.
Yeah.
It needs four drives. And so it's two striped drives that are mirrored. So you get the speed of the striping and the safety of the mirroring, but it takes four drives.
It's the expense of four yeah. drives to do it, yeah.
Now, there used to be a company called Drobo, and I'm so mad they went out of business.
Mm.
They had this interesting RAID they called Beyond RAID. With most RAID systems, you have to have identically sized drives. So if you put a 1 and a 2 in, it only uses 1 gigabyte of the 2.
Mm-hmm.
With Drobo's Beyond RAID, you can mix your drives together, and it automatically builds the biggest RAID it can to have redundancy if one drive fails. So
yeah.
we had a lot of people get a four bay drive array,
mm-hmm.
and you just stick your old drives in it as you replace them in your other computers.
Right.
And so you could pull a small drive out, put a bigger drive in, and you magically get more space on the RAID.
Yeah, it's true. Drobo isn't around anymore. A company that I've been using is Synology.
Yeah,
I have one of their units good. At my house.
But they need to have the drives be the same size, which is pretty typical.
They do at first, but you have the ability to replace drives later on. One of the other downsides to RAID is that if you ever want to expand it,
mm-hmm.
You have to take all the data off of it, then put in your expanded drives, and then format it and make it ready, and then
yep.
put all the data back.
That was another thing that Drobo did. When you set up your RAID, you tell it how big you think you might go.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone just said, well, I'm going to do 16 terabytes because that's the max we could do.
Sure.
And then whatever capacity you actually had would start filling up that 16.
Right.
So you could grow into 16 terabytes without reformatting and re-losing any data.
Right. With the Synology equipment, you can actually pull out a drive at any time and replace it
yep.
with a larger drive. The unit will detect the capacity of the new drive and then reorganize itself
to take advantage of it. So essentially it's
Yeah,
yep.
it is. It, not only do you get the ability to set hot spare and cold spare drives so that you can swap them in case a particular unit happens to fail, but you get the flexibility of not having to pull all of your data off, reformat and reconfigure the RAID, and then put all the data back on. So you get some flexibility there. Now,
and
it should be said, RAID is not a backup, so it will protect you from hardware failure, but it doesn't protect you from accidentally saving over a file or accidentally deleting a file.
Backup.
Yep. So oftentimes you've got your 200 terabyte RAID,
mm-hmm.
you need another one to back up onto.
Yeah, it's true, and that's when cloud storage comes in handy.
Yeah.
Tell you what, if you want to hold on, we'll come back to you right after this break. But for right now, I'm going to put him on hold, and we're going to take a short break, folks, but we will be back with more here at Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to this edition of Soundbites. We had Will on the phone still with us. Go ahead, Will.
Well, we were talking about backup, and I was wondering if I could ask you guys one question and then hang up and listen to your response. And it's about, I know how much you guys are Linux aficionados, and I've been converted. I now use Xorin myself. I recently got wind of an app called TimeShift, and I would like to hear about your experiences with it, and you know what you have done with it. And if I may, I'd like to just listen to you guys and hang up, if that's okay.
Did you say Time Ship with a P?
Shift, F-T.
Shift. No, Shift with an F.
Okay.
That's a new one for me. I'm not familiar with.
Fill us in a little bit, there, Will.
Presuming you haven't hung up. Okay.
It functions in a manner, from what I understand, equivalent to System Restore on Windows.
Okay.
And my understanding, I just downloaded it recently, and my understanding is that it's also useful for backing up files. And I thought perhaps maybe you guys might have had some experience with it.
We have an offhand. It's sort of a backup program.
Nick is more of our guru for Linux and Unix.
Okay.
I know enough to be very dangerous.
Okay.
I'm reading as quickly as I can.
I play around quite a bit with the Raspberry Pis and that type of stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I got to admit, I'm just getting into more and more into depth with Linux and trying to slowly, my goal is by the end of this year to totally replace two more of my Windows 10 machines with Linux.
Yeah, I see a big warning here that TimeShift is designed to protect system files. It is not a backup tool and excludes user directories by default.
Oh.
So it keeps your system intact. So if you load a corrupt driver or screw up something in the system, you can get your system files back up and running.
Which is key, because sometimes if you don't have that up, you can't then get at your other data.
Now, if you're running a distribution like Ubuntu Linux, there's an app called Deja Dupe that will
like
help
that.
But yeah, TimeShift by itself sounds like it's for protecting system state.
Kind of like Windows Restore, System Restore. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's still, Will, you know, even with Linux, you know, there is backup, and backup. We can't say that there is no operating system out there that you don't want to have some other form of offsite backup.
Yeah, the 3-2-1 backup strategy. You need 3 copies of all your data in 2 different locations.
Mm-hmm.
On 2 different media.
Types of media.
And one of them should be offsite.
Now, that rule was invented back in the days when sometimes people would back up to tape and sometimes back up to recordable disk or magneto-optical. And
then store them all in the same office that gets burgled or fire or flood. Yeah.
Well, our expert just texted in. Nick said, TimeShift is a system restore utility.
Yeah.
It takes snapshots of your system at regular intervals, which can be restored later.
Right. You know, Dennis had mentioned about Deja, and I think that is part of what I have. But the thing is that when the automated backup occurs, I downloaded some of the files, and it was like it was all JSON stuff, and not stuff that I had intended to back up. So I don't know what's up with that. I'll have to
play around.
Right. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Good question. I check it out and be sure to call us either later in the show or next week.
Yeah, let us know
what you learn.
Yeah.
That way I'll learn something too.
You probably have to set backup parameters about what you want it to back up and don't want it to back up.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Maybe I don't have the correct backup parameters set.
I just found a nice tutorial on linuxconfig.org on how to back up with Deja Dupe.
See, I'm always still
Dupe. Okay.
Which one were you talking about?
The same one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Deja Dupe.
Obviously, put that link on the soundbites page.
Yep. I am still of the mindset, whether it's Windows, Linux, or anything else, it's if you've got your data backed up, trying to do these restore programs and all that back, or your system, putting it back, that's usually a good indication to when that happens, your system crashes, just start fresh. It can be daunting and a pain in the butt setting back up, but there's something in there that, you know, caused it to crash, and you might not find all the little tentacles that are out there that caused that crash. So starting fresh, at least you got a clean slate to work from, and then just put your data back.
Sometimes in a mission-critical environment where this database has to be up and running now, having a system image you can restore instantly can help.
Well, Nick pointed me to this one program that he uses that you can take like an image of, say, all the programs that you have running on your Linux machine.
Right.
So you get the basic system back up, and then you run this other program, and it goes out and gets all those programs and installs them for you.
Yeah, I've got a tool like that on the Mac called Homebrew, and I keep a list of the files that I care about, and I save that to some of my cloud storage, and it's just a text file. And then I can re-import that and say, all right, Homebrew, go take a look at this list and everything that's on it. You know, that's your shopping list for this trip. Go ahead and grab all those things and install them. And then I come back, you know, half an hour later, and poof, I've got all my apps I care about.
Yeah.
Now, are you guys still archiving the programs after the broadcast?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. We've never stopped that.
Yep, and we're doing that, and they're also available as a podcast feed. So if you're interested in subscribing, you can get the latest show.
The audio files are on our website under Audio Archive, and then we have the video files on YouTube as well.
Yep.
If you really want to be scared. You know, it's early in the morning, and all of a sudden you go, what the heck? Oh, that woke me up.
Well, there they are.
See those faces in the morning.
But thanks for giving us a call.
Yeah, on that note, I'll certainly say farewell to you guys. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Have
we'll
a great day.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's always fun learning new stuff. Yeah.
And scaring people.
And scaring people, yeah. And I liken back to the early days of DOS and the early Apple IIs that you turn it on and there's a blinking cursor.
Right.
You write your own program. You figure out how to do it yourself. And we're kind of back to that with Linux.
Yeah.
You can have a pre-configured Linux with a GUI that looks exactly like Mac or Windows.
Sure.
But tinkering, the tinkering with it is fun. Yeah.
Tinker with it a lot.
You develop your own technology itch, right? Of you've got an idea or something that you think, oh, you know, it would be really fun would be if it could do this. And then you start to dig into that a little bit further and investigate, learn a little bit more and, you know, maybe get a false start or two and try it out. And then the next thing you know, hey, I've got this little app that does exactly what I wanted and it scratches that itch. And suddenly you get the satisfaction of having solved that puzzle.
All right, we got another caller. We got Bob. Where in New Mexico did you say you were, sir?
I'm about 25 miles south of Albuquerque, a village, Los Lunas, L-O-S-L-U-N-A-S.
Okay, yep,
very good.
Did you take a left turn at Albuquerque?
No.
You know, that's a cute cartoon. But no, we moved here on purpose.
Very good.
Well, so how's the heat out there, though?
You know, it has been terrible. I felt like I've lost 2 months of my life being cooped up inside with air conditioning. From about mid-June through last week has been just in the low hundreds, 102, 103 kind of numbers. And it's just, other than first thing in the morning, too hot to do much gardening or walking or anything. So.
Yeah, that's what my sister-in-laws say. They're out in Phoenix, Arizona, and the heat out there for those folks
are like
just
living in an oven, I'm sure.
Oh,
amazing.
But it's broken such that high 80s or 90, 91 is normal now. So great.
Right.
So how can we help you today there, Bob?
You know, the topic is being hacked. My wife has an IHG account, which is you and I know them as Holiday Inn, Holiday Inn Express, hotel chain. They have a bunch of other things. They hacked into her account that stores her points. You know, when you go to a hotel, you get so many points, you accumulate enough of them, you can get a free night or something.
Yeah,
yeah.
She just happened to be on the computer on a Saturday evening and got an email from them saying you're secondary contact information has been changed, as well as your telephone number. If this is you, call us. She called. Lo and behold, just minutes before that had been changed, and they even whoever did the hacking actually booked two nights at a resort in Sedona, Arizona. And my wife says, that ain't me. You know, we're okay. Home. We're not going anywhere. So they were very nice. The people in Sedona that stole the information hadn't checked in. She canceled that, gave my wife her points back. But within maybe another 2 minutes after that, her email started getting flooded with spam. Bitcoin or health insurance things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the most common cause of being hacked like that is a password reuse.
Yep.
Some website got breached. It's never you. It's never your computer. It's never you doing it. Right. Some website got breached, and they lost your password. If you use that same password on other services, then the bad guys will try that password on other places. Recently a program or a web service called Seven Rooms. Oh, no, that's restaurant management. I thought it might have been a hotel management. So there have been billions and billions of leaked passwords, and that's typically how they get in. The other way is going through a forgot password link. And if your forgot password instructions are too simple to guess, then that's another way that people can get into your account.
Security questions.
Your security questions,
One thing I would suggest, you say it's too hot to go outside.
Yeah, now that you're inside.
Now that you're stuck inside and you got all this time to do stuff, what I would suggest, and we've been suggesting for the past couple of years, is a password manager program.
That way it can generate complex passwords and unique passwords for every website.
Yeah, and you only have to remember one password. Nick and I use what this program called EnPass. That's ENPASS. There are others out there, and they will literally create complex passwords that I guarantee you nobody's going to guess them.
Yeah.
So what you do is you start install EnPass up, and it'll back up your stuff to, say, if you got a Google account, up to your Google Drive. So they're available to you anywhere, whether it's on your phone or your tablet, or if you're in another city and log into a computer, you can, a system out east here, you brought your laptop and you're logging in. EnPass can connect and know all your passwords, so it doesn't have to be on that particular computer.
Apps can store all your passwords. The company itself does never sees your passwords. They're all encrypted, and the company itself couldn't get your passwords if they wanted to, because they are they're stored in such a way that they are only available.
And most of the password managers use a service called Have I Been Pwned to check to see if your email address or password has been seen in a breach. So I've gone into some people's computers, and it says there's 72 password breaches. Mm-hmm. So pretty much every one of their passwords have been breached.
I mean, it's going to take you some time to set up.
Yeah, the first thing to do is change her password with this Holiday Inn company.
Yeah, right. and
probably her email password.
And then every site that you go to, you use passwords. You can usually go into that particular site and say, change password.
And what you do is manager create a long one, and you paste
you
that
just
in
have EnPass over on the side of the screen. You log into EnPass and you say, okay, create a new set up the account for, say, Holiday Inn, and you can then say, okay, generate a password for me within that little tab. It'll generate as long or short of a password that you want. You can copy it and then go back over to the site and paste it in there. That's all you have to remember then, because EnPass will remember it from there then on.
And since she started suddenly getting a lot of spam emails, it is very likely then her email address was seen in a breach.
Yep.
And the spammers added that email address onto their spam list so they can send out more junk mail.
Yep. That's how they make money.
Yeah.
Is by selling to other vendors her email address and a lot of the spyware and everything else collects all that stuff. When they get into somebody's machine, they grab the email list and they go, well, why would they want that? because they found they can resell all those email addresses for a profit.
And if you get an email from someone you know, you're more likely to trust it. Mm-hmm. So the bad guys will use those addresses to send the spam, hoping they'll catch someone that will open it anyway because they trust who it came from.
Yep.
So there was a problem a few years ago. Marriott bought Starwood Hotel Systems, and Starwood had a persistent breach. The bad guys were in the Starwood hotel reservation system for years, literally years, collecting passwords and driver's license numbers, passport numbers, and no one knew it until Marriott bought them and started doing security audits. And so 500 million people who had done reservations through Starwood Hotel had all their accounts lost and their passwords and passports, as I said. So it's never you. It's the other end.
So we would, recommend taking the time, and both of you set up, a program like NPass and get your passwords changed.
The industry, security industry has been trying for years to come up with a better thing than passwords. And right now there's a new system that's being
tested
and it's available called Passkeys. And Apple's supporting it, Microsoft is supporting it, Google's supporting it.
Yeah.
And it uses the biometric data in your phone. So the other end doesn't have any secrets to keep. So it's the other end that loses your password. So they have to store your password. When you log in, they compare what you typed with what they already have stored. And so when that company gets breached and they lose the stored password, that's where the problems start. So if you don't give that company any secret to keep, then it's a lot safer that way.
Right.
And so using the biometric Face ID, Touch ID on your phone or your computer tells the other end, yes, this is who they say they are because I've already verified it, then it's theoretically going to be a lot safer. The problem is that we have 50 years of passwords inertia to overcome.
Right. Yeah.
And everyone's used to passwords. So there are some websites now that allow pass keys. You'll start seeing it's a silhouette of a person with a key sitting next to them, where you can turn on pass keys on your account. The problem has come up is that there's a third-party passkey vendor that a lot of big companies are using instead of doing it themselves.
Right.
And the problem is fallback. So if your passkey doesn't work, they fall back to a password or a PIN that can be compromised, and then it's not any safer.
So does that help you out?
Almost. Where I was going to go with this conversation is I've been a long-time listener, and we have indeed started the different passwords for each account and very complex using NPass. That's already in motion.
Good.
And my wife was at first just one by one hitting report to spam and filtering out each one of those. But they were all different addresses to the tune of hundreds.
Yep.
But she noticed they were all at outlook.fr from France. So she just put a filter in her star dot, report as spam and delete from pop server or anything that worked.
So you can do that unless you have friends in France that you email with.
Exactly. So where this conversation is going is, do you have a recommendation for different email accounts? Should we be using one for friends and one for businesses?
And then have a throwaway account that you set up for some mail. You want to get on a mailing list to read this one thing, but you don't necessarily want to fill
any of their services.
Yeah.
You create what I call a dummy one that I never go in and check because I know, and matter of fact, if I get anything from anybody, I know it's junk because if it pops up into that folder, it's like, it's just...
I think that's kind of overkill. I think what I've done, I use Gmail, which is Google's tool, and I've been using that for a long time. Back when they were having, it was so new, they were having invitations. You had to come and be invited to use it.
Yeah.
What I did is I set up a filter that looks for the word unsubscribe, and it filters based on that word and sticks any particular thing that contains that word, and it tags it with a particular tag, and I tell my inbox to not display anything with the word unsubscribe in it. That way, day to day, or actually, no, it moves it to spam.
I was gonna say it gets trashed.
And, you know, that doesn't help for the industry mailing lists or
there's some mailing lists I want vendors, to read.
But in general, that's been more effective for me. I think you definitely can set up multiple accounts, but that can be an additional thing to have to remember. Depends on, you know, if you feel comfortable keeping track of those things in your head, that's fine. But I think there could be alternative ways to look at it, too.
Now, Nick talks about using one of the Google tips, and I'm trying to find which one it is, to put a ignored piece in your email address.
It was like a plus sign?
Yeah, I'm trying to find that.
So, let's say you said you were Bob. If you had, your local power company wants to tell you about air conditioning tips, but you're thinking, well, I want to read the tips, but I don't really want to give my actual email address to the power company. You could say, at least with Gmail, and I don't know about others, you could say that your email was Bob plus...
All the way around.
Or, I'm sorry, airconditioning plus Bob at gmail.com. And that way they have the ability to send you the message, but they don't end up with an... you have the ability to see... something you can sort on and move to a particular folder or track accordingly.
So they're easier to filter out. Now, Apple has started a service called Hide My Mail.
Right.
So they, when you're going to create an account somewhere, they will make a new gibberish mail account that automatically forwards to your real mail account.
A relay.
So the other end and never get your real mail address. And if you start getting too much spam from that fake address, you just turn it off, and you stop seeing that spam again, because the other end never got your real address.
It is kind of a cat and mouse situation, and it really depends on, number one, how big is the problem? Two, how much effort do you want to put in? Three, how much time do you want to spend maintaining it over time? Those are all, you know, factors that go into it.
Right, because we use the same email for friends, family, mm-hmm. and businesses, and that's it, one email.
Yep.
So she was going to say, tell her friends to start using a different one. I go, well, that's going to take a year for your friends to get used to a new email.
Right.
Yep.
Well, and plus, I don't know if it changes the problem. It just kind of kicks the can down the road because it's a limited amount of time until somebody you would prefer not to have had that address, some company or some spammer, ends up getting it. And then you're kind of in the same situation again.
Yeah, so that's kind of the bottom line to stop spam is get a new email address until that address gets on the spam list.
It's a temporary.
And it's just temporary solution. and then you got to tell everyone the new address and it's a pain.
You know, what I had read is, you know, they hacked their account, so why would they send spam?
That was probably somebody else. It may not have been them.
Yeah, tell you what, Bob, if you want to hold on, we've got to take a break.
Hold on.
All right, and we'll come back to you, so just hold tight, but for right now, we've got to take a short bio break, as Nick would say. So go ahead, go get that other juice drink or rest stop break or whatever, but we will be back very shortly with more of your questions and answers, and Bob from New Mexico, so stay tuned with more sound bites here at Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
On Facebook at Jazz 901 FM.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to the second hour. For Sound Bites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dennis Worcester.
And we still have Bob from New Mexico on the line. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, we were talking about being hacked and then suddenly being bombarded with hundreds, if not thousands, of email spams. And I couldn't understand why they weren't just satisfied with hacking. Why the follow-up with emails? And what I learned was that they want to cover their tracks, so when you get a legitimate email for reservations from a hotel or your phone number has been changed, please contact. So you'd never see it buried with it, hundreds and thousands of emails.
Yeah, smoke screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, we've been saying for years the bad guys are getting smarter, and that's becoming a bigger and bigger problem.
Yep. Right. Well, they're trying to find ways of earning money. And like I said, that's why we tell folks, you know, to run the spyware and the malware, because that's what they're trying to do, is sniff people's computers, grab their email list, and resell it to spam other people.
And that's a pretty smart thing for them to do, to spam you with stuff like that. So you miss the occasional, you've changed your Amazon password, is this really you?
Right.
And no, it wasn't me, but you didn't see that message because it was in the middle of everything
else.
You
were just click happy.
So just to end this, I want to thank you for your show. You guys do great. I really miss Nick as well as everybody else in the audience, but you guys have definitely stepped up to the plate, and the show goes on, and I love listening to you weekly.
Hey, I'm going to ask you to do us one favor. Just tell some of your friends out there in New Mexico to tune in to us every Saturday here at Jazz 90.1.
Right. Now, it's noon Eastern, but what time does it come on out there?
Are you 3 hours?
10 and Mountain Time.
10 a.m.? Okay. Yep. So, you know, have your cup of coffee and tune us in.
You guys don't play around with daylight savings time, right?
No, we do. It's Arizona that doesn't.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah. That's right.
I get my states mixed up.
Well, we're too far east. All of those states out there tend to blend together for
us. But, hey, Bob, thanks much, and please keep us informed.
Thank you very much, too. Take care, guys.
All right. Yep. See you.
And you can always get video on demand on our YouTube channel.
Yes.
And audio on demand from our website.
If you go to jazz901.org, you can listen to a live stream of us. Right from the studio. And if you go to the Soundbites webpage, the Soundbites channel on YouTube, you can get a live video stream. Every week, Steve sets up several cameras, including this one. Hello, everybody. And we can see ourselves and also let you see us, too. And that's 100%
too scary.
Free. And it's something that we provide just so that you can see us and hear us and enjoy the show.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Larry from Rochester. Go ahead, Larry.
Good afternoon, guys. Recently, I was talking to a friend of mine, and we both have Zoom accounts. And he was saying that Zoom either wants to, is going to, or already has laid claim to your Zoom meetings and that they want to own them. I don't know if I understood, and I hadn't had time to really research that, but I was just wondering, had you heard anything about that? Because to me, if I have a meeting that I'm assuming is private, and all of a sudden Zoom owns it, I've just lost my privacy, depending on what Zoom or someone else is forcing Zoom to do.
Right, yeah. So I do know some about this. I don't know enough to be an authoritative source, but I can tell you what I've heard so far. Zoom changed its terms of service, and what they wanted to do was to train some of their artificial intelligence or machine learning models on the types of content or the conversations that were happening. And they changed their terms of service in such a way that by using the service, you automatically agree to these by having created an account and using the service. Lots of people noticed this, and word spread very quickly. And there were lots of people that said, well, you know, I'd really prefer to not be included in this Zoom, if you wouldn't mind, including many businesses, because it wasn't just the casual consumers that were being affected by this. It was corporations and universities, and they were very interested in not being included in this either. What ended up happening was that enough regular folks and enough corporate customers started making a big enough stink about this that Zoom reversed course and said, nope, hang on, we're going to reevaluate this. We're going to remove that part of our terms of service, And this is not something that we're going to do, at least in the near future.
For now.
For now. So I encourage you to find some more primary sources.
I found an article on The Verge.
Okay. And maybe it has some other information that I wasn't entirely up to speed on. But that was the gist of it that I knew about. And I knew that there were some local universities that were none too happy about this and were actively discussing it
because,
at the highest levels.
Sending out private information.
Well, and there are many universities nearby and across the country who make use of Zoom who have regulations. You know, they have contracts with corporations or with the government and need to make sure that what they say is sufficiently private.
I've just read something similar with HIPAA laws that for a medical office, if you use Google Analytics on your website, you are breaking HIPAA law.
Oh, really?
Because those analytics are recording data about people who visit your medical website.
Right.
And so you better turn off Google Analytics. But yeah, so I'm seeing on this Verge article that what sort of happened is that pieces of their license that said we are allowed to show video content, which they have to have that right to do that, so your people can see your content, kind of got stuck in with sections about their AI learning tools and what content it's going to learn. So it was never. The CEO of Zoom is saying it was never their intention to do that. It got confused.
Mm-hmm.
Probably too many lawyers involved.
That's their story, and they're sticking to it.
Yeah.
According to the AP, the company quickly responded with a blog post on Monday stressing that it will not use audio, video, or chat customer content to train our artificial intelligence models without your consent, and added a line to the terms to make that clearer. There are online privacy experts that say that the policy is now accurately reflected in the document, but the terms do still allow Zoom to train AI on other data, for instance, such as how customers behave and they question how much choice some meeting participants will have to opt out if, say, the boss decides otherwise. So there's a lot to figure out. But the current terms do not allow the company to tap user-generated content like video and chat without a customer opting in. But once a meeting host agrees, the other participants have to leave if they don't want to consent.
Yeah, we've already seen now that if you start recording your Zoom meeting, the other end, the people that join the meeting are warned that that's happening. So they can decide if they want to keep attending or not,
right?
Knowing they're being recorded.
But if it's your company that's using Zoom and your boss has started the meeting and started the recording, you know, for whatever reason, then it's there's a weird power dynamic there where your boss is doing this, but if you don't want to be involved, you have to just not join the meeting.
Well, I just basically decided that if Zoom was actually going to do that, I'm out of Zoom.
Okay.
I'd find another way to do it.
Sure.
It's not that I'm trying to plot against the government, but you'd like to know you have
some privacy.
Privacy level when you're holding a Zoom meeting. That was the whole purpose of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Zoom eventually made enough money to buy privacy companies so they could combat a bad reputation.
And I'm going through their terms of service now, and basically they are retaining ownership of the software. And in Section 10.4, you retain ownership of all of your customer content.
Right. Well, I need to look at that a little more. I was just I was concerned about it, and I thought I'd call and ask while I do my own homework. But if it looks like they're going to breach that and say, okay, you're no longer private, Larry Floyd is out of there.
Yeah, I hear you,
well, that's your choice. Yeah.
Well, here's an interesting clause. Zoom is not intended to use by children under 16.
Okay.
Unless it's a school subscriber.
Right.
So your 16-year-olds can't use Zoom at home.
Sounds that way.
Well, not intended to use Zoom at home. Yeah.
That part doesn't bother me anymore.
Yep.
Okay, guys. Well, I just thought I would call. I figured someone would have a little bit more information than I have, and as usual, you guys are a wealth of information, so thanks for being there.
Thanks much, Larry. Yep. Talk to you later, my friend.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a tricky situation, and there's a lot about this that was sensationalized in headlines, And then the article goes on to describe kind of the dull details, and I don't think a lot of people were necessarily reading all of the article.
Yeah.
So, dear listeners, if this is something you're interested in, be sure to read the entire article and be fully informed. A headline may not be sufficient on this particular topic.
Yeah, a lot similar things happened in YouTube in the early days when there was some change in the terms and conditions about YouTube owns the right to broadcast your video.
Okay.
Well, yeah, they have to have that right if you want anyone to see your video.
Right. Otherwise, it's just a cloud storage.
Cloud storage, yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Patrick from Batavia. Go ahead, Patrick.
Okay, guys, great show as always. I have a situation. I bought a computer and monitor a few years ago, and it came with a cable. I'm thinking it looks like a DVI cable, which I'm not really familiar with. But
okay.
I wanted to upgrade my monitor, and I bought a monitor that had I'm going to buy a monitor. It looks like it has a DVI, HDMI, and a VGA port.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But the problem is I bought one that only had HDMI, and this computer doesn't have an HDMI. It has something called a display port. They call it a DP.
That's right.
And so I'm wondering if I don't have an option for HDMI and I do have a VGA, would it be any issue? Will I have to change any settings on the monitor?
You can get a display port to HDMI or DVI to HDMI cable fairly easily. So there were computer video standards. VGA is an analog standard, one of the very oldest standards.
It's been around.
And then DVI was the digital video interface that supported larger and larger monitors.
And that's only about half as old as VGA, but
right.
VGA is decades old.
Yep. And then DisplayPort was an enhanced version of DVI to support even larger monitors. So in the early days, 17-inch was a large monitor.
Yeah.
Today, 24 inches is a small monitor. And then, meanwhile, in the television world, HDMI, the high definition multimedia interface, came out, and so television started getting HDMI. So your Blu-ray players and your cable boxes would use HDMI. And then somebody along the way figured out, hey, let's put HDMI on a computer, and then you can use a TV as a monitor.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of what happened. And so now most monitors are coming with HDMI. Most computers are starting to now come with HDMI.
With 4K color resolution.
Right. Yeah. In the early days, television was very low resolution, 640 by 480, no matter how big your screen was.
Right.
Then they added HD, which is 1920 by 1080, and now 4K, 3880 by 2660.
Mm-hmm.
And so the TV monitors have caught up to computer monitors. That was always a question too. Why does my 30-inch TV cost $500, but a 30-inch monitor cost $5,000? Well, because it's significantly higher resolution, millions of more pixels. But yeah, you can get either a DVI to HDMI adapter or a DisplayPort to HDMI cable to use your existing computer ports with the new HDMI only monitor.
Yeah, when I started reading about it, I read something that said that not all of those converters, HDMI to display port, were functional and had something to do with the digital format of the DV.
And it can depend on the monitor resolution. If you just have an HD monitor, pretty much any cable will work. But if you have a 4K monitor, you need a special 4K HDMI adapter that can support the higher resolution.
But coming out of VGA port ain't going to be that much.
Yeah, VGA is going to be pretty low quality anyway. The other thing with HDMI is the refresh frequency. 30 hertz cables will be cheaper than 60 hertz cables, but you want 60 hertz or better. But then it also depends on what your monitor is. So we're starting to see TVs coming at 120 hertz and 240 hertz.
So what can you tell us about your monitor?
Yeah.
Well, what I can tell you is the plug that what I think I call is a DVI plug.
Okay.
Is blocking the information about the monitor. So what I'm hearing from you is I believe the VGA, it comes with a VGA cable. So I could start out and plug that in and then I'll be functional.
Yeah.
But if I decide I want something better, then I've got time to go out and look for these other.
That's right.
Adapter, other tables.
What type of computer is this? Is it
a Dell?
A Dell box. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah,
laptop or desktop.
Desktop.
Well, you can. Yeah. All right, if you've got an HDMI port on the back of this new monitor, you can pick up a HDMI video card relatively cheap. You know, $50-$60.
A cable will be cheaper, but a new video card might give you better quality anyway.
Yeah, it's going to give you the better quality. You know, you take if this is onboard video that I take it that you're using right now.
I didn't really.
Well, when you plug it in, you know how the back of your computer you have those slots? And then there's also an area where there's the USB ports and the mouse port and all that stuff. Do you hook the...
I would have to look at it because...
Okay. Sounds like sticking with the VGA to start with is probably a good step one. You already have the cable for it. You can connect that up and see how it looks. And if it's acceptable to you, hey, that's great. You're done. If you think that it maybe the colors aren't quite as the way you'd like, or that the picture is a little fuzzy, and you're leaving some sharpness on the table, then look into a cable that is specific and has the two ends that you care about. The one being HDMI and the other being DisplayPort. Usually they'll either be an adapter built into the cable or there's a converter box.
But the thing of it is, though, even though if he gets that cable, it's not going to improve the quality because the quality coming out of the computer is still VGA.
But he has a second port.
If he has a DVI port on it, then it does have the digital signal, too.
If he goes from the monitor, DVI, but not VGA.
Right.
What I think is a DVI. But the one I know for sure is called the DisplayPort.
Yeah, DisplayPort is very small.
It's deceptive. It was close to the size of an HDMI.
Right.
So I tried plugging it in one way, and of course it doesn't go one way. You flip around. It doesn't go the other way. And then you go, what? So I went to the specs on the computer, which I found online, and it said, I looked very carefully, there was no HDMI. There were two... display ports.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the guy that built the machine added this card for that DVI because I didn't see anywhere where they said it included it.
Could have been, yeah. DVI is about an inch and a half wide, maybe half an inch tall. Three rows of pins. Of holes, basically, the male port on your cable would go into the female port on the computer.
And there's a space in between.
A space, and then, a bunch of other four pins and a horizontal slot.
I remember about putting it in, it was a bear getting it in, which is why I'm a little reluctant to just pull it out.
Because it's got so many more connectors on it. It's 34 pin.
You've given me several options, and I think one of the things will come down to is how easy it is to find a place that sells that cable.
Yep.
In a small town, we don't have that many options. Mm-hmm. I do travel, so I may find it. So I think I'm going to go with that route, the VGA, and then decide what to upgrade because I want to at least be able to use my printer is hooked up to that computer upstairs.
Uh-huh.
So anytime I do want to print something, so I had it turned off, but I'm thinking that's the way to go.
One of the places that I've gone for cables, especially ones where I know I need something slightly unusual, I've gone to monoprice.com. They are a company that specializes in cables, monoprice.com.
I will look that up. Thank you.
Yep.
And I will probably also re-listen to this.
Sure.
Because at my age... memory fills up quickly, and then I got to wait for the buffer to clear.
Hear
some more stuff.
It's true.
But that's the beauty of you guys having this recorded, is that we can go back, and especially if you have a thought going one way, and your ideas all go to the other way, it's hard for us to change our mind. But I will listen open-minded. And thank you, Ken. And we wish Nick the best of health. So he's not back.
He's listening.
And thank you so much for that. And I know that Nick thanks you as well, and we look forward to hearing about your success when you call us back.
Yeah, probably it'll be a week or so to get to it. But
all right. Have fun with it.
I will report back, yes. And have a good day, Nick.
All right. Yep. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye bye. Sure. Then.
Yeah, it's tricky when it sounds like he's got a slightly older PC with VGA and DVI on it, but the monitor is got everything.
That's really old though to have still VGA port on it.
Yeah, VGA and DVI is an old. Those are two older standards. And the monitor itself is trying to do its best of having relatively modern HDMI and then still having the fallback
VGA.
And
Apple used mini VGA and mini DisplayPort on many of their computers.
I'm thinking that box has got to be at least 7-8 years old.
Probably.
Oh, easily.
Now we're starting to see most computers and most monitors going to USB Type-C.
Yes.
And then it'll have a USB hub in the monitor because it's a USB connection anyway.
Oh, I've got a story about that. So the USB hub is fantastic because you can use your laptop like a desktop. You can set up an external Bluetooth keyboard and Bluetooth mouse, and you can connect one single cable to your laptop, and it can sends power, so you can charge the battery for later on. Hmm. It sends the video. Your monitor has a built-in Ethernet jack, so you can plug into wired Ethernet. And it has several USB ports, so you can plug in other things like a cable to charge your phone or things like that. One of the downsides is they have a setting on the monitor that nerfs your network connection. So if you're used to getting high-speed networking, it can either prioritize the data rate going to the monitor for your video, or it can prioritize the network speed.
And, but not both.
Yeah. So I was trying to figure out, why the heck is my network so slow? And I had to go into the monitor, believe it or not, and say, oh, no, prioritize the data speed, not my video, because I'm not playing games or movies. I'm just doing windows on a screen trying to do my day-to-day work. Yeah. So but when I adjusted that one, then everything was just fine, and I got back to real life and didn't have to worry about a slow network anymore. But that was annoying for a couple of weeks trying to figure out what could possibly be slowing this down.
Yep. And it's weird because as a gamer, you'd want both fast refresh and fast network.
Right. There were a couple of challenges. I will say this was a Dell monitor. They have two different lines. They have the UltraSharp line and they have the Performance line. And one of those is Mac compatible, and I bought the wrong one. So there's one that has some Mac compatible utilities for window management and other things, but the one that I bought was not that particular one. But the one cable lifestyle of having USB-C connected directly to your laptop still is very, very convenient. I do recommend it.
Yeah, because the computers, well, the current box that I got didn't come with a DVD drive.
Yep.
And again, there's mouse ports are gone now. Keyboard ports are gone.
All the PS2 stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's all PS.
Everything expected USB. To be wireless these days.
USB or Bluetooth.
Yep. All right. Tell you what, folks. We got to take a quick break. We have, I forget who was on the line. I suffer from CRS. But hey, stay on the line. We will get back to you right after this break. It's a relatively short break, so don't go far. More of this coming on Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to this edition of Soundbites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And I forgot the gentleman that we had on the phone. What was your name again, sorry?
Tim.
Tim, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Like I said, I'm trying to do too many things here at once, Tim, and I apologize for forgetting your name. How can we help you today, sir?
No, that's absolutely okay. I am really struggling with this challenge that I'm having. I'm switching phone carriers for the first time in about 20 years, and I'm with Verizon. I think I have to say that because my question relates to them.
Okay.
I use their Verizon Message Plus for all of my texting, and my concern is, and the new carrier that I've spoken to, multiple people, as a matter of fact, they can't assure me that when I switch to the new carrier that all of my old texts are going to be there. I have important stuff relating to work. I have pictures, even some video content, And gosh, I don't want to lose all that stuff. I can't lose all that stuff. So my question is, will I lose all that stuff? Some say, people say no. Some people say yes, because it's a Verizon Message Plus app, so you won't be with Verizon anymore. So you lose it. And or is there a way to back it up? And it would be an awesome bonus if I could back it up and actually look at it on my laptop.
Right. So for our listeners who might not be familiar with what this is, I've done a little bit of research while I was listening to your question. Verizon Messages, or Verizon Message Plus, is an application that that particular carrier makes available to its customers. And it has a few different features. They say that it is a texting app, and it lets you synchronize your texting conversations across all of your compatible devices. You can also make and receive calls on a tablet, which may or may not be possible otherwise, because your tablet may not have a direct cell phone, direct connection to your cellular provider. You can also customize conversations with backgrounds, bubble styles, fonts, and more. They also say you can send e-gift cards to family and friends, and you can also access additional features during a conversation, like Glimpse, Yelp, reminders, driving mode, and more.
Regular text messages is just text.
Right.
And more companies are adding more and more features, like emoji.
Yes.
Google's pushing their rich communication system.
Mm-hmm.
Apple's got their own iMessage.
Right.
But they're not compatible with each other, so it falls back to plain text.
So, yeah, if you're switching providers, you might be nervous that the information that has gone into this particular app, whether it's from you or from the other people that you're communicating with, is kind of stuck inside this area. And if your new provider doesn't have a method to query that data store and import those things, you rightfully are concerned that conversation and that information might go away or become yep. inaccessible.
Fortunately, there is a way to export those messages using the My Verizon app on your phone. There's an export feature. It exports it into a comma-separated value text file.
That's good.
So you'll be able to read it humanly.
Right.
You may not be able to import it into your new texting program, but you'll at least have it in a file that you can refer to when you need to.
And when you say, and that was my big concern, is I was afraid it was all going to turn into code. You're saying that could I access it online?
So
you'd have to upload it to some online service, but it would be a file on your computer.
You'll receive it's essentially a file that will have information about the day and the time that the message was sent, who it was sent from, who it was sent to, probably the content of the message itself. And every single message will be on its own line in this file. It's going to be text, and I won't say that it's code per se, but each one of those pieces of information that I just talked about will be separated by a comma. That's what comma-separated values means. And you'll be able to take a look and scroll through that file. You'll be able to use whatever searching capabilities are inside the application that you're looking at the file with, but it won't appear in the same area on your new phone from your new provider that you may have been using in the past. So it's going to be an entirely different point for reference, but it won't necessarily be the same place that you're seeing new messages.
And then new messages will come into the text app on your new phone, and old messages will be in this file that you can open up and look at.
Now, I'll be using the same phone.
Okay. The same phone. Well, if it's a different provider, the Messages app itself, from what I'm seeing, is available on Android phones. I don't know for certain if that app goes away when you switch providers. You can tell me what you've learned, Steve.
Well, I would say that's the problem, is that all the cell phone companies call it Message something.
Okay.
And so Google Messages is different than Samsung Messages, is different than Motorola Messages, different than Verizon Messages. So none of them are basically cross-compatible except for the raw text message. So you'll save, using the My Verizon app, you'll save the text messages to a file either on your phone that you could open up in a text reader on the phone, or to your computer to see those old messages. And then new text messages will come in to the probably the Android Messages app rather than the Verizon Messages app.
That was the big question. I was wondering, would Verizon Message Plus let me keep their app when I change carriers?
Probably, and your old messages may stay in that app, mm-hmm. but new messages will likely come into the Android app.
Oh, well, I would not be able to use the Verizon Message Plus any longer?
Probably not to send messages, but you may be able to use it to see your old messages.
Oh, that would be great. Can you promise me that?
No.
Yes, as long as you don't hold us to it.
Can you promise us we're not going to have snow this year?
Yeah.
We can pinky swear.
Okay. We're seeing what Verizon has been posting on their website on how the messaging Message Plus app works. Here's a question. Can y'all use Verizon messages on a non-Verizon device? Let's see what they say there.
All right.
Is it going to be Verizon messages will work, but it won't integrate into Verizon's cell phone number. True, because you're not using Verizon anymore.
Right, you're not using them as a carrier.
So you'll be able to scroll through your old messages.
You just can't use it to send any messages.
New ones. All right. So
send or receive.
This could be good news for you.
Yes, I think it is. I can't tell you how many hours I've spent trying to research this and find out, but that sounds right. It sounds like that's the way it should be.
Yeah, the app is there, but you just can't. In other words, you can view what's already there,
right?
But you just can't send or receive any future stuff.
Because it won't talk to Verizon services anymore.
Right, because it's on a different...
What's your... Excuse me, who's your new carrier?
Pure Talk.
Okay.
Let's see if they happen to be using Verizon's network.
That would be interesting. I would say it sounds great if you'll be able to keep the app on your phone. On the off chance that something that we don't fully understand yet might happen, I would do that export feature.
Yeah, just to cover your butt.
Keep a copy of it elsewhere, off the phone.
It's like no different than what we say about backing up your computer and everything else.
That way, if everything goes sideways, you've got a copy of it that you can
you can rely and go back on.
You can check on.
Yep.
And best case scenario, you do the work and you never need it.
Yeah, but you still got a backup of it just in case.
Do you suppose as part of doing that backup would require me to download something onto my PC?
Yeah, you'll need to move that export file, and either send that to your PC. An easy way to do that would probably be to attach it to an email message that you make on the phone itself just email it to yourself.
Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yep. Steve, were you working on a question there?
He's
still engrossed into it. So tell you what, if we find out anything more, we'll stay tuned and we'll put it out over the air, okay?
Yeah. That's great. Thanks for your help today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, stay tuned.
So, most of the answers are it should work. And no one posted back saying it did work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it seems logical. I
mean, yeah.
But, unless sometimes part of the science of it is trying it out and then seeing what happens. And sometimes you get pleasantly surprised, and other times you get some result that you weren't expecting.
Yep.
That's technology for you.
Okay, hold on. We'll head down.
It sounds like
the wonderful thing about standards is there's so many of them to choose from.
Right. Well, and every company's got different priorities, and very rarely is one of them interoperability. Everybody wants to lock you into paying them.
Now, like in the Apple world, you can use iMessage to send text messages from your iPad through your cell phone.
Right.
So you can send and receive text messages on your computer and your tablet by using your phone. So that's what this Verizon app did for Verizon customers.
Yep. All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Jim from Brighton. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, I have a question. I can no longer find Steve's notes. Used to be, I thought, on the page where the where his voting would take place.
Okay.
Is there a new way to link to it?
It's right on the front page. It's called Search for Show Links. The current links are on the front page, and there's a button that says Search for Links. that you can search for the old links.
All right. Give us that web address one more time.
It's at soundbites.org.
Okay. So go there and check on the front page, and you'll see the notes about the latest show.
Or you can search on old ones.
And then you can go and see. Yeah, you can go. So you can keep seeing previous pages, 25 links at a time. Or there is a link right on the homepage that says search.
All right.
Go back to it. Search the show links.
Very good. I hope that helps you find what you're looking for.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for giving us a call. And I know that we've helped you and also everybody else who's listening.
All right, as Dave is quickly. No next caller yet?
No.
Dave's rolling calls and
we're caught up on the calls. All right.
I'm the one guy here who just gets to smile and look pretty.
Yeah.
So, did you find out anything further on that for the gentleman?
No, I haven't found anybody that said, yes, it works. It's all.
Now, dear listeners,
well, that's why I think, for him, the best thing to do is, like we said, you were advising him to do, is take the time and back him up.
Yep.
Email him to, himself, and then, matter of fact, I'd email it a couple different places if you can, and save it. And that way, it's a fallback. But if he's lucky enough to go to this new carrier, because a lot of them are cross-linked, even though,
sure.
They share service, they're on the same pole and everything else.
Well, that's kind of why I asked him who his new carrier was.
Right.
I can't find QTalk to see who they were.
I'm guessing that's an MVNO.
Right, yeah, but Googling it doesn't find anything.
Okay, so there are some primary carriers.
Maybe it's T-Mobile
and Verizon,
not Q,
and AT&T,
not the word Q, the letter Q.
And then there are what I'll call secondary carriers. Those are companies that buy wholesale bandwidth from the primaries. The primaries they have the towers, they have the repeaters, they have all the transmitters and the receivers. They've spent all the money on the network, but there is a certain amount of capability that the network has that's greater than what those companies need.
Yep.
And they can sell that bandwidth to secondary companies. And those companies are able to often offer really good service for a discounted price.
Right.
And I think that's what one of these folks might be.
Yep. All right, let's go back to the phones. We got Dennis in from Rochester. Go ahead, Dennis.
I've got a desktop Windows 10 PC. Over the past couple of weeks, all of a sudden, it takes 2, 3, or 5 times of pressing the on button to get the monitor to react, to come on. I've already switched monitors, and I've already switched cables. You guys have any other ideas as to why it's...
Is the computer turning on when you push the button?
The computer does turn on.
Then, okay. You know what? I had this happen to one of my monitors because I've got dual monitors.
Okay. What'd you do?
What I had to do was I went to one of the local stores, like Home Depot or that.
Okay.
And got this, what they call turn on, turn off switch.
Okay.
So instead, because your switch on your monitor is probably getting ready to go, which on my one monitor went.
Okay, so the switch itself.
But just before it went, I was able to go to the store, get this extension cord, and it has an on-off switch at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you plug the plug into an outlet, and then you plug the monitor into that.
Right.
And you can, instead of hitting the switch on the monitor, I just hit this little white switch, and that turns the monitor on and off because it's the switch internal to the monitor that was going on mine.
Okay.
And I've been doing that now for 3 years, 4 years.
So, caller, did you say that it, or yes, Dennis, I remember, because it was my name. Hello. Hello, other Dennis.
Well, I had an older monitor, and I got rid of that and got a new monitor and a new cord, and it's still doing the same thing.
A new monitor and new cord, still the same thing.
Was the new monitor the same resolution of the old one?
Yeah. Or do you get any messages on the monitor itself saying things like signal not detected or going into sleep mode?
What happens, I get nothing.
Could be a video card.
I get, when the monitor does come on, I get my blue power on light. Switches from whatever it is.
How old is this box?
7 years old, maybe.
Okay.
Might be the video card starting to go. How many video ports does the monitor have on it? Maybe it's looking at the wrong one.
It's got a VGA and DVI.
You may want to bring up the menu in the monitor and see if there's an auto detect port, or make sure it's set to the right port the computer's putting out, because maybe the monitor is not set to the right port, so it's not showing any video.
Right.
Okay. The video is integrated on the motherboard. Mm-hmm. I was thinking maybe I either need to get a separate video card, or maybe get another power supply or something like that. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, a video card wouldn't be a bad idea if you can find one at a price that's reasonable to you. The type of connections you might get on a new video card may be fresher and newer than that monitor. A monitor that supports VGA and DVI might be a bit older.
It's like we were talking about earlier, most new monitors come with HDMI now.
So either finding the appropriate adapters to adapt to that older monitor, or potentially finding a combo deal where you can find a more recent monitor might be another way to go.
And you also have to know what kind of slots you have in your computer so that you know what to get the right video card.
Right. That can be tricky. It's all doable, but there's some details that all have to match up just right, and if you don't get it right, it's simply just not going to work. It probably physically won't fit in the machine. So these things are all something that can be figured out, but there are just a lot of details to make sure to match up.
Okay. So first thing is to go into the monitor and see if I can get it to lock on to the DVI, which is what I'm using right now.
Right. Make sure the monitor's set to the DVI port.
Okay. All right.
Let's
thanks,
start with
guys.
That.
Yep.
Thanks. Great. All right. Thank you for calling.
Yep.
Yeah, monitor connections are tricky.
And
making sure that you have the ports that you need, it's difficult to buy monitors now. You have to pay attention to the types of connections that they offer. Many times, the more modern monitors offer only digital connections. They offer VGA or DisplayPort, but they don't go back to, digital VGI, DGI, DVI, thank you. But the older displays simply aren't able to keep up. It's easier to take a more modern video card and adapt it to an older monitor than it is to go the other way around to have an older computer.
It's also possible that the computer is set to a resolution the monitor doesn't support.
Yes.
That was a big problem for a while.
Or a refresh rate.
So apparently on Windows 10 and 11, if you hold down the Windows key, Control, Shift, and B.
B as in boy?
B as in boy, yep. I don't know why they didn't use V as in video.
That would make too much sense. They don't do that sort of thing.
Yeah, it will reset your graphic driver.
Okay.
So then the computer and monitor should talk to each other and tell each other what they can support.
Yep.
I loved when they added that feature into monitors, so you didn't have to load the driver and pick the resolution and the frequency.
Yeah, that made life a lot easier.
Monitors...
Boy, they sure have come a long way. You can get an awful lot of monitor for a couple hundred bucks now.
That's one thing I was surprised at. One of my radios, it'll support, an external monitor. But I was surprised because it's a relatively new machine, radio, that it supports, instead of HDMI, it's DVI.
Mm.
And it's like, I'm so used to HDMI now because the quality is so much better, the 4K monitors you can get.
And the connector is smaller.
Yeah.
A lot of companies started using DVI because it's physically smaller connector.
Yeah.
And easier to fit in their backplane.
And on the back of this radio, it'd be so much easier. Like you say, it'd be a smaller spot and modern technology, keeping up with go figure.
Well, and a lot of them will do HDMI now because it gives you so many more options about what you can plug into the monitor. You can plug everything from an older DVD player to a modern 4K Blu-ray player to a computer to, you name it. And that's That's just a nice, a compatible standard.
And a lot of times the TVs now have multiple inputs.
Yeah.
Well, because you had your cable box, you had your Blu-ray player, you might have a game console.
Right.
You can plug a computer in, too.
Sure.
And then you can use your, you know, 65-inch living room TV for your computer.
Yeah.
I plugged my flight simulator computer into it so I could fly on the big screen.
Oh, fun.
Well, the newer computer I got, the Dell box, it came with its own monitor. It's a 4K monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think it was a Spectrum monitor.
Okay.
But the clarity on this 4K monitor kicks butt.
Because, they're starting to do the 120 hertz or even 240 hertz. So the faster it refreshes, the better it looks.
Yeah, you don't see the pixels anymore. Yeah.
Remember when The Hobbit, was it the first Hobbit movie came out? It was high refresh rate. So instead of the 24 frames per second, it was 48 frames per second.
Right.
There were so many complaints that it looked too real.
Too real. Yeah, it looked fake.
Yeah, it didn't look like a movie.
Right.
Because we're used to 24 frames per second.
Yeah.
It looked too real. It looked like a window. And I'm thinking, great.
Yeah.
That's how I want my movies to look.
What's wrong with that?
I haven't seen any other movie since then.
The problem is I went back to watch an old episode of NCIS on our new TV, our 4K TV.
Yep.
And the problem is you can see the set and how much it looks like a set. You can see that the brick on the side of the building is really just wallpaper that looks like brick.
That happened with IMAX in the early days of IMAX. They realized the sets had to get better. Costumes had to get better.
Right.
Spider-Man is 50 feet tall. You can see the stitching in his costume.
Yeah.
Well, even the actors hated it because, it'd show if they had any blemishes or anything else.
Or freckles.
Yeah. That they didn't want shown. It's like, you better cover it up. The clarity is so fantastic.
The new Avatar was available and was shot in 48 frames.
Okay.
And then they released it in 24. So theoretically, there's a Blu-ray somewhere that has the original 48 frame per second. But then you need the Blu-ray player that can support that, too.
Right.
Yeah, it's terrible. Streaming.
The more things you think new technology is going to make things simpler, but sometimes it expands your options.
Yeah, add a layer of complexity to it.
The technologies try to make choices and configure themselves to talk to each other, and that's fine as long as they all pick something that's reasonable. But when they don't, that's not really being helpful like they intended to be.
Yep.
So sometimes we, as technology people, have to try and anticipate what the conversation between these two ends is going to be and then figure out what they might have decided on and how that might have been a problem.
Yep.
It can be a big challenge.
Well, I should mention before we head out, this weekend is the 20th anniversary Northeast Helicopter Jamboree.
Woohoo!
Out in Macedon. 20th anniversary we've been doing this.
Where's it
going to
be?
It's in Macedon, 2529 Macedon Center Road, near the junctions of Route 31F and 350. I put a link in our show notes, too. Tonight, doing night flying about dusk, so 7 to 8 range, and fireworks starting at 9 o'clock with light-up helicopters and airplanes flying in and around all the fireworks.
Oh, boy.
That is
a great time.
Wow. Well, hey, folks, I want to thank both everybody for calling in and taking the time to spend their Saturday with the three of us. I know Dennis and Steve and I really appreciate it that you do take the time to call in with your questions and take this section out of your day to be a part of ours. So with that, we will be back next week, Saturday, in another 166 hours, as Nick would say, with more sound bites, your questions, and hopefully some helpful answers. So, save the date, and we'll be here. Have fun.